My guest today, Augustine Burroughs, is the author of a series of novels and incredibly transparent, funny, provocative memoirs, including Running with Scissors, which is the story of his early upbringing after his mom, who was dealing with mental illness and other things, ended up dropping him at the house of a local psychiatrist to be raised in what he depicts as a kind of a wildly untraditional and at times abusive household. That book became a massive bestseller and a movie back in 2006, starring people like Annette Bening and Alec Baldwin, Evan Rachel Wood. And along the way, he's continued to write. And when asked if there was anything he was holding back, because he's known as being so transparent, so real, so open, he'd always answer no. But in his latest book, Toil and Trouble, we learned there was, in fact, a very, very big and deep secret that he had been keeping to himself for his entire life, one that was central to his identity, and it was time for it to finally come out. He didn't mean for it to happen. It literally just started channeling through his fingers into the computer, which he described as essentially destroying while writing this in such haste. In today's conversation, we explore Augustine's upbringing, his early career in advertising, which is kind of amazing considering he actually kind of stopped his education in primary school, his descent into addiction for a lot of years, and then the moment that would pull him out of it and send him back into the world of writing and the career and the life that he has now. So excited to share this with you. I'm Jonathan Fields, and this is Good Life Project.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Life is full of what ifs. Some awesome. Like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome. Like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Good Life Project is brought to you by Understood Explains, a podcast that's like a beacon for parents navigating the special education system. Hosted by Juliana Urtube, a special education expert, this season is all about individualized education plans, or IEPs. Juliana breaks down complex topics like how to tell if your child needs an IEP in a way that's easy to grasp. I checked out an episode of Understood Explains about the difference between IEPs and 504 plans, and I was struck by the balance of empathy and practical advice. It's not just about understanding the system. It's about empowering parents and caregivers to advocate for their children, which is just so important. So I've known a number of people who've had to literally scramble to figure out how to advocate for their kids when the system seemed to just make it so hard to get the support that they need and deserve. So if you're a parent navigating this world, or even just wondering if it's right for your family, I encourage you to give Understood Explains a listen. Search for Understood Explains in your podcast app. That's Understood Explains. It's like having a roadmap for a journey you didn't expect, making it a little less daunting. Very often when I sit down with somebody who's written a memoir, you know, sort of like the story of their life, you've written memoir, but you've written memoirs, plural, that tend to really focus in and zero in on almost like seasons of your life. And it's been interesting also because you haven't done it chronologically as well. It wasn't like I'm going to start in the beginning and then slowly work my way up to the present.
Right.
But the early years, I think have been pretty well documented by you. It involved you, like Northampton, a dad who was a professor of philosophy, and also, as you've written, a distant man.
Yeah.
Is that putting it mildly?
Yeah, right.
for those who don't know you and your work and your story, it's really the earlier days also, and your mom who really struggled with mental illness. Mm-hmm. Paint the picture a little bit of what the early days were like.
Okay. Well, my parents met in college. They were both from the South, from Georgia. And my father proposed to my mother by saying, if you don't marry me, I'll kill myself. So that, there you go. From day one, things were off to a bad start. My mother was a poet. She was a painter, and she was a poet, and she earned the terminal degree in the arts, her MFA. And my father had a PhD and was a professor of philosophy, and then later the head of the philosophy department. He was also an alcoholic. And in retrospect, he would probably be diagnosed as sociopathic. Hmm. He had a sort of a mask that would appear in public when he was very, very polite, you know, to the people at the checkout counter, and he would always have a smile. But it repeated himself, you know, being a professor that he was. But as soon as he turned his back, the smile was gone. And when he would be drunk, he would be very sadistic. I mean, he didn't spank me. He didn't do things like that. He haunted me, you know. He did much more. More clever, sort of more diabolical little things. So my parents had a terrible, terrible relationship. It was just nonstop fighting. My mother was, when I was about 11, it began 11, 10, 11, 12, mental illness just took over her mind. And she, they went for marriage counseling with a doctor, an untraditional doctor. This was the 1970s, and he was very, very untraditional. And he wildly mismedicated her, and she just went off the rails. My parents divorced. My father was out of the picture. My mother couldn't raise me, and so she signed me over to this doctor. And this doctor lived in this large, crazy, old, falling-down pig pen of a house with several of his biological children and other adopted, you know, children, long-term psychiatric patients. And there was a pedophile, his adopted son, who lived in the barn behind the house, and he became, you know, my special friend. So I was sexually molested from a young age, and that was totally fine and encouraged, you know. It was like, I mean, it was no secret that we were lovers. And it was only actually when I was an adult and a therapist explained to me, well, no, that wasn't a relationship. If you were a little boy, that's what sexual abuse is. It's when an adult takes advantage of the dynamic, the age difference, you know. I mean, that's completely wrong. You may have, you know, felt older, but you're not. You're a little kid. You can't be in a relationship with someone who's, you know, in their 30s and be that age. But there was also a lot of fun. I mean, it was a lot of fun. There was no bedtime. There were no rules, no supervision. And it was just a crazy, very eccentric life. The one thing I think I learned was to depend on myself because I had no adult around me. I was terrible. I was bullied at school, and I left school. The fourth grade is the last grade I ever completed academically. And there was no adult I could go to say, look, here, this is what's happening. So I had to figure it out on my own.
Yeah.
And later on in my 20s, you know, I got into advertising as a teenager. I was very successful, and it was very easy for me, and I started drinking right when I got into advertising, and I was an alcoholic for a long time and went to recovery, and that's another book.
Right. I mean, what it's interesting— You know, at a young age, mm-hmm. you become all the voices that you need because effectively, like, there's nobody to turn to and say, is this okay? Is this not okay? Is this good? Is this bad? Is mm-hmm. this, like, constructive or destructive?
Right.
You know, and it's like, it's all got to be internalized, which mm-hmm. I can't even imagine. You know, like, at any mm-hmm. age, I think everybody struggles with that through. But to be sort of, like, young and in an environment where you literally have to play every role in your life and don't really feel like there's a single person that you can look to help.
No. Right. I mean, I learned a lot of really tough, hard, ugly stuff. I mean, I remember when my mother first left me with the doctor in the doctor's house, when I realized, oh, this isn't overnight. This isn't for a week. This is it. I mean, I had been like a really prissy kid in my polyester suit in a very neat, immaculate house. My mother could have been an interior designer. She had an amazing taste. So we had, you know, all this sort of Danish modern furniture and white shag carpeting. And to go from that sort of world into absolute physical and emotional chaos felt catastrophic. And I can remember feeling like, I'm going to die. Like, I'm like, I need my mother. My father was out of the picture. So now I don't have a mother. And like, kids, like, you got to have your parents or you. I mean, I really thought I was going to like die. I didn't know how. Yeah. Like a heart attack or something. And it was a real rude awakening for me to realize, wow. So wait. When we took that trip when I was 5 years old to Mexico, my mother, her best friend, and her best friend's little boy, who was my age, also five, he got lost in Mexico City. We found him. But for a while, he was missing. So I thought, well, what if that had been me? Like, would I have died, you know, at five? And I thought, well, no, really, because I could have found somebody would have found me and loved me or taken care of me somehow, you know. Or if not, I could have, like, you know, eaten out of dumpsters. And so technically, I guess I don't need parents at all. And I realized that really young. Mm. And parents are, and I tell this to young people now too, who struggle, who have maybe abusive parents or parents who are addicts. You know what? Parents are a luxury. That's the brutal truth. They're a luxury. I mean, if you have one parent who loves you and takes care of you and is supportive, you have one parent lotto. If you have two, off the charts. If you have none, hey, that sucks. But that's the way it is. So you absolutely have to accept it. And you're going to have to do this on your own. And you can. And no, it's not fair, but fairness is not woven into the weft and weave of the universe. Fairness is not a thing. It's not. It's a fairy tale.
Yeah.
A lot in life is absolutely not fair. And so you've got to then work with it. And it's best to, that's where honesty comes in. Being honest with yourself, telling yourself the actual truth. Okay. This is what it really is. I don't want to have to look at how ugly it is, but this is how ugly it is. So what can I do from here? And that's empowering. That does give you strength, because that's when you tap into your own inner reserves. And I think I did that from a very, very young age. Yeah, and
which I think is one of the things that's so unusual, right? Mm-hmm. Because I think a lot of us come to the conclusion, I think, at some point in our lives that, you know, like the everything is equal, everything is fair sort of quote mythology, you know, is largely that. And mm-hmm. we are, you know, like in no small way responsible for a lot of where we end up. And of course, there are circumstances that control a certain part of it. But to come to that realization at a point where the average kid doesn't have the skills, the coping mechanisms, the cognitive abilities and presence to actually understand how to step into the role of being intentional. I mean, it's not only unusual, but then to actually be that person who steps into it and says, okay, this sucks, but let me own it. And how do I actually move forward from here? Really unusual and extraordinary. Not necessarily a good thing to have to experience that early in life.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like it taught you something about yourself and the world in a season where most people don't have those lessons.
Mm-hmm. It did. And I think, you know, one thing that I believe, because people have said similar things to me, they've said, you know, I don't think I would have survived that. What is it about you? As though I have some sort of special survival, was born with a factory installed toolkit for surviving. Right. And I think that, you know, people have far greater reserves for survival than they may imagine. It's true that the majority of us don't have this kind of a childhood. You know, they're not left entirely on their own. but there are a lot of people who are.
Yeah.
And who do have to fend for themselves.
Yeah, and develop, I mean, resilience at a very young age.
Mm-hmm. You can also become, you know, very bitter and angry.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I never did, because I don't blame. I mean, blaming is a useless thing. Just like an apology, really.
Yeah, but as a kid, like, how do you not go to that?
Because it's not efficient.
Yeah, but even not as a efficient. Kid, like, yeah, your mind, I you're got telling that. Yourself.
Yeah, it's not, like, blaming is not going to, it's, okay. So as a kid, as a really, really, really young kid,
yeah.
I was obsessed with what we now call theoretical physics. Yeah. I wanted to understand, where are we? What is this? I mean, what is this? You know, I was very, you know, thoughtful about things. And to focus on what I didn't have, or the wrongs that had been done, or my mother's illness, and the neglect that resulted from it, those moments have actually passed. Time is like a river, you know, it just goes. And that moment that I just said the word, it goes, that moment is gone now from the world. It doesn't exist. The person I was when I said that, not even 18 seconds ago, is gone. So every single minute, everything is reinvented. Everything. We are brand new every second. And to focus on the past or to blame isn't going to alter anything. It's going to keep me trapped. It's going to keep me trapped. And the reason I know that is because for a while I did it. I absolutely did. I spent years being furious at my father and focused on him, and, you know, and it's like it wears a neurological groove. You know, you wear a neurological groove into yourself, and it becomes difficult to break free of it, because really, we want to have understanding of why things happen to us in a certain way. We want closure, and that's not a real thing. Like, you can't get that. You're never going to understand why so-and-so did something to you. Never, because you can't really get inside of them. We don't get answers. We don't get closure. That's not part of the deal. So you've got to accept that. And when you move on, you don't need it. Nah. Because you're not living there. You know, it's like when people talk about being haunted by the past. A lot of people get stuck in life haunted by the past, but that's not accurate. If you're really honest with yourself, you're in the shower one day and you've bought a new shampoo or a new conditioner because it was on sale. You've never tried it before. Squirt a dime-sized dollop in your hand, and the smell of it brings you back instantly to when you were 16 and a half, and you have this flashback of actually something horrible that happened when you were 16 and a half. And so you revisit it in your mind. You go back and you think about that horrible day, that horrible thing that happened to you. And you allow yourself to go back and feel those feelings, and you can feel the hormones rushing through your body, the stress, the adrenaline, the fight or, you know, the flight or fight, and getting worked up. And the past does not haunt us. We haunt the past. And learning not to do that, practicing that. Not doing that is how you move forward.
Yeah. So when you're moving through, you end up not in school. Eventually, though, you go back and get your GED.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as you shared, you go into the world of advertising in New York. Why? What was that about? Like, what was in it for you?
So at first I had gone, as a teenager, I enrolled in a trade school that doesn't exist anymore. It was called Control Data Institute. It was to learn how to program computers.
I think I actually remember commercials for that.
Well, it's funny you say that, because it was actually right before graduation when I saw a commercial on the air for Control Data Institute. And it was like, hey, you there on the couch,
right.
You get up and train for tomorrow's career today. And that's when it really hit me that I'm not at MIT. I'm not at Harvard. I'm at a cheesy trade school. And that ad is so horrible, I could do that. Like, I could do that better. And then I realized, like, advertising, people, like, do that. That's a thing. Like, that's a career. And ads are disgusting. I mean, they're all horrible. So I can clean it up. And I sat down and I rewrote all the ads in a magazine and I started calling ad agencies. And make a long story short, you know, I got a job in San Francisco. I had to move across the country, but I got a job in advertising and I was immediately very, very successful. I mean, I won everything I ever pitched. It was like, because I'm good at it. I am really, really good at solving problems instantly. I mean, I can remember UPS having they were a client, absolutely freaked out when Federal Express became FedEx because it was sexy. They're purple. They felt like we're dowdy, we're brown. And I was trying to explain to them, you are ubiquitous. Once I started working on your account, I saw a UPS truck every 30 seconds somewhere. So what you have to do is you have to not paint your trucks. You just have to be more brown. You have to be, you have to define brown. And they didn't get it.
Right.
That was the one failure.
Oh, the beige.
They didn't get it. Later they did.
It's interesting the way your brain works. When you look at the world of advertising, because I think a lot of people go into that because it's expressive and creative and flashy and sexy, and you see it all, you know. And
it's none of those things, actually.
Right.
It's tedious and disgusting.
But it looks like the way your brain approached it was, okay, so here's a clear problem. Mm-hmm. For some reason, my brain works in a way where it solves that problem, like, fairly readily and in a really good, quick way that's helpful. Mm-hmm. And it was more like math for you.
It was a puzzle. It was not ever about writing and, I mean, looking back, I really shouldn't have been a copywriter. I should have been on the strategic account side because what I'm really good at is knowing positioning. I mean, I know what a brand should be. I was not the best in terms of creative. Like, there were way more creative people because I didn't really care about, the thing that really mattered to me was the point. Like, what are we? Like, what's the solution? The solution for you, UPS, is to actually embrace your brown and be more brown. Go do it. You know? But I had to be the one to actually go do it. And I was also an alcoholic and it got into my drinking time. So
yeah. And that's also, so that's the backdrop of all this. Like, that's the bigger context is that, you know, like, you're out in the world, you're earning a living, you're doing this thing, you're really, really good at it. And at the same time, you're living a whole separate life in the bottle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a lot of people do, I think, you know, but I would, you know, just live in squalor. I mean, I just lived in absolute squalor. I was a bedwetter. I was the kind of drunk who'd wet the bed and never change the sheets. They'd be dry by the time I got home, and I never took the bottles out. So I had thousands of empty beer cans or bottles in the apartment, depending upon what I was drinking. And it was, and then I hid it or tried to hide it. It was just, terrible attempt, I think, to, you know, run away from myself and to escape. I want, you know, oblivion, to not really look at certain things. Writing was an accident. It occurred accidentally.
Take me there.
Well, I had, I went through rehab and I got sober. And then the only person I was close to in my life, he died. And I decided, oh, yeah, I did not get sober for front row center seats for this death. So I'm going to drink again. And I did. And, you know, I had all the symptoms of hallucinating spiders and all the symptoms of late stage chronic alcoholism. I quit advertising and did it freelance so I could get paid while just writing from home. I never had to actually see people. And one ordinary morning, for no reason at all, I sat down at my disgusting table and started to write. Now, at this time, about a year and a half, I watched Home Shopping Networks because back then there was no live television, believe it or not. like when you turned it on, I mean, it was, you know, watched CNN, for example, they would be playing broadcasts from earlier in the day. However, Home Shopping was live 24 hours a day and it was having company. So I would just have it on, you know, just have it on for company day and night. And so, like I said, one morning I woke up and I started writing, and it was just this silly thing about a show host, you know, who accidentally exposes himself on the air. He's wearing, it's a Slumber Sunday sundown event, and he's got a bathrobe on that they're selling. But backstage, you know, a latte had been spilled on his boxers, so he took them off, and he's wearing a robe, but the robe opened, and it was, you know, sort of like, you know, a wardrobe malfunction on a big scale, and he was fired. And it was just this sort of rompus through the, like, the world of a Home Shopping network, and it was a little novel. And
I mean, when you sat down and just that starts pouring out of you, did you have any intentionality behind it, or
I just was. I had no idea what I was doing, and I just know it made me laugh, and I hadn't laughed for, you know, so long. I just kept writing that day, and I was like, "Where are these people coming from? Where is all this coming from?" And when I drank that night, I didn't reach that sort of place that I used to reach when you drink. And an alcoholics, and if you have any alcoholics or recovering alcoholics or drug addicts listening to this, they will know what I mean when I say I didn't reach that place. It's that destination. And that's a frustrating feeling. Like, where is it? So I wrote the next day. I got up even earlier, wrote more, drank less. Third day was... The story had taken over. It was not a conscious, I wasn't sitting trying to figure things out. I wasn't like, okay, so that character just came in. None of that. I was just sitting and the characters were like coming through my fingers. Fourth day, no drinking. Couldn't do it. No time. Seventh day, I finished the book. And I didn't know if it was, you know, any good, but it had page numbers and chapter titles, and, you know, so it was a book. But I had a profound realization, which was, this is the escape I was looking for. I'm never going to drink again. I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. This is what I'm going to do. This is like, this is it. This is this. This is it. This is it. And I never did drink again. And so that, that book, actually, I did, after being turned down by every agent in the city, the last, you know, one I approached, signed me up, took me on, and sold the book. Right. And for an advance large enough for a brand new wardrobe from, you know, The Gap.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Good Life Project is sponsored by NetSuite. So I remember when our businesses were just starting to really scale. It was amazing and also added complexity and stress. And the things that I used to do in hours were taking days, too many spreadsheets, too many systems, no single source of truth. That sounds familiar. You should know these numbers. 37,000. 25 and won. 37,000 businesses have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25. NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind. So you get a customized solution for all of your key performance indicators in one efficient system with one source of truth, manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. Everything you need to grow all in one place. And right now, download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/goodlife. That's netsuite.com/goodlife to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/goodlife. Good Life Project is sponsored by Lexus GX. So have you ever owned something that inspired you to just up your game? For me, it was this high-end mountain bike. I love the ultralight frame, the suspension, the precision gearing, and I realized it deserved to be ridden to its full potential. So I started training harder so I could experience the joy it could give back to me. And it paid off. That bike helped me discover just new levels of performance and straight up joy. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Imagine tackling rugged landscapes with the available 33-inch all-terrain tires and multi-terrain select, then unwinding with the available front-row massaging seats. This is a vehicle that inspires you to go further, to live up to its full potential. So why settle? Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
I didn't have any other ideas for a next novel, though. But what I did have was a diary journal that I kept when I got out of rehab. So I gave that to my new agent. And imagine giving a stranger your journal. I mean, I've been keeping journals since I was a kid. So.
Yeah, especially the journals that take a reader into the childhood that you had.
Mm-hmm. Well, these journals were about recovery. So I just got out of rehab. I don't know what I'm going to do. There's a crack addict in group therapy, and I think I'm in love with him because he has psoriasis like my father and a Southern accent like my mother, and I am so sick. And I mean, it's just all this embarrassing, terrible stuff, and I gave it to my agent, and you know, he took a while, and then he got back to me and said, why didn't you give me this first? And I was like, what do you mean? And the reason I gave it to him was because I didn't have another idea, but I had this other style, if you will, of writing, which is when I just write for me. I mean, I'm not writing it. Like, the novel was weird. I'd never written anything like that before. The normal writing I do for me, like, can I use this? I mean, it's a terrible word, style of writing, but this writing I do for me, is it useful? And he said, this is a book. And I was like, it is. So my publisher, who bought my first novel, they purchased Dry. And I was flabbergasted. And when I say Dry, what I mean is they bought my journal, my diary, now called Dry. And I thought, wow, okay. So if you like that, I should tell you a little bit about my childhood. So I was raised by a lunatic psychiatrist who dressed like Santa and scooped his turds out of the toilet and laid them in the sun to dry and would divine the family fortune from the shape. And there was no school. And I was molested, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And they said, go write that book. So I did. And, you know, a lot of that, actually everything in Running with Scissors, I hadn't thought of until I sat down and wrote it. I mean, I had a few stories that I would tell, very, very curated stories that I would tell people very selectively over the years. I had an eccentric upbringing, you know?
Right.
But I never actually thought about the things that happened. So memory is most reliable the first time you access the memory. Each time you access a memory, the memory is altered through neurotransmitters. And the first time that you access it is the most accurate that you will ever be. And it's the only way that I've ever, it's all I've ever trusted. So when I write like when I wrote about running with scissors, I was blank. I couldn't remember. I was like, I don't remember anything at all. The process of remembering occurred on the page, and it was like watching a movie. So I would watch whole scenes unfold with dialogue and people, what they were wearing, and I wrote it, and that's it. There we go.
So, I mean, it sounds almost more like transcription.
I felt like a court, exactly right. Like a stenographer, right. I was watching, I describe it as like watching a movie and typing as fast as I can to keep up. And after the book, you know, the book was very popular. It sort of hit a nerve, right. And no one expected it to be. I mean, they didn't print many copies, and it was not the kind of book that was selling at that point in time. It was 2002, so all the books on the list, on the New York Times bestseller list, it was all about dead presidents and history, and
right.
There was just not this. But it exploded in a big way, and along with it came a lot of scrutiny and journalists asking, first of all, being very dubious of my upbringing, because I—
Right, like, is this actually—
I speak well, you know, and I'm sophisticated. And I went to fourth grade? Really? That's all? Really? You know, and just, a lot of people have really found it very, very, very difficult to believe that I had parents who were as well educated as they were and would allow molestation to occur. And then there was the issue of, how do you remember such perfect dialogue? You know, you're lying, you're making it up. And I never had a really good answer, because it's like, well, you don't remember? Really? Like, you can't remember being— I remember learning to walk. You don't? What's wrong with you? I mean, it's just like, what? I didn't know how to answer that. And I also thought and said, so when you're a journalist, it's a very, very competitive field, probably more competitive than advertising. You do not get a job at the New York Times or Time or Newsweek or without having gone through a very, very prestigious school of journalism. And you're not getting into that prestigious school of journalism unless you've gone to one of the Seven Sisters or the Ivy. Are they Seven Sisters or six?
Six or seven, yeah.
And so to get into that Ivy or Seven Sisters school, if you're going to, you know, Smith College or Harvard, you had to be top of your class in high school, which means you had two parents who were on your butt to do your homework. You were probably not giving blowjobs at 12 to a mental patient. So your exposure to this underbelly of life is limited to Quentin Tarantino movies. And that's why you don't believe me, because it's not part of your reality. But it turned out that a lot of people had a very similar childhood. I mean, I will never forget my first big reading in Los Angeles. Outside, it was just around the block, and it was filled with celebrities. And if they weren't famous, they were somehow in the industry. And it was just a sea of $5,000 Gucci jackets, and I was mortified. I mean, I was like, oh my God. Look at these cool, beautiful, popular people. I am a zoo animal. What did I put in that book? This is a nightmare. And I felt just the deepest regret that day. And I just wanted to get through this horrible event. And I realized I had made a terrible mistake by revealing this about myself. Now that I saw these cool, groovy people smiling at me, I was like, oh, this is horrible. And then one by one, they came up. You know, the guy who won two Oscars, man, thank you for writing this book. I was also molested at a really young age, and it was just so comforting to read this. Thank you for writing this book. My mother was also bipolar, and it was just such a relief to read this. Thank you for writing this book. And it was on and on and on, and I was like, whoa, wasn't expecting that. And that's how it was from then on. Not everybody relates to everything I write, obviously, but there is somebody who does relate to everything, even the tiniest little thing.
Yeah, and apparently enough people.
I mean, because
it's interesting when you write the way that you write. You know, it's interesting to know that, especially when the first book comes out, or not when the first book, the third book really, but the one that kind of really blows everything mm-hmm. open, Running with Scissors, it becomes this mass thing, that there was so much pushback around the idea of credibility. And it's interesting to hear your frame also, which is that so many of the people who were kind of coming at you and questioning everything, you know, very likely came from such a profoundly different experience of life.
Oh, incredible privilege.
That it's like, how do you even conceive of other people living that way?
Exactly.
And then to go out into the world, mm-hmm. and once the book starts interacting with you, and you start actually talking to all these people who are reading it and saying, and you're just getting this perpetual validation at volume of like, no, in fact, a lot of people haven't lived my exact life, but pieces of it, it's much more...
I never
common.
Had any pushback from readers ever. I never had doubt from readers.
Nah.
Readers never were like, you betrayed me. Readers, because you know what? The truth. Okay, so when you read something that's true, it's like you feel it. You know, there's like a scent or an aroma. So readers would be like, whatever I was writing about, it's like the readers were like, I know exactly what he's describing, because that's what I did too. And you only know that if you did it. So it was, I had these two worlds, this sort of public media world where everything, you know, was suspect in terms of my memory. And then the fans who were like, yeah, I recognize that. You know, it's interesting because many years later, my primary care physician, a year after knowing me, called me and said, you know, I've suspected this for the first time I met you, but I wanted to know you for a full year. And now that I do, you have ADHD. And I was like, what is it? You know? And so he put me on Adderall. And I was like, what is Adderall? I looked it up and it's like, wait a minute. I'm going to be on like speed, like uppers, like in the 50s. This is like not a good thing. Like, this is not going to help. So I mean, I'll never forget taking the first pill. I'll never forget it, because all of a sudden someone said something to me and I heard right away what they said. And that's when I realized, oh my God. You see, all my life people have said to me that I should have my hearing checked because I have a hearing disorder, because I ask people to repeat themselves a lot. Excuse me, what was that? Hmm. And all of a sudden, someone said something to me and I heard it. And it's because I didn't automatically repeat exactly what they said silently and very quickly in my mind, which I had done every single day for my entire life and never known that I did it until this moment, when suddenly I didn't do it. The other thing was that it relaxed me in a way that nothing else ever, ever had. It was just like, I felt like I'd been raised by like two surfer parents in California, like from Half Moon Bay, you know? It was just like, whoa. I mean, it's funny because it's like after I took the pill, I would have to get to work. Otherwise, I could just sleep. And my doctor was like, okay, so that's what we call a neuroatypical reaction. And that's diagnostic. So he then sent me to a psychiatrist to make sure that this was correct. And the psychiatrist asked me a series of questions that no one had ever asked me. Does the back of the tags in the back of your t-shirt bother you? And I was like, yeah, as a matter of fact, look at the hole from pulling out the tag today in the cab. Is your skin really sensitive? And I was like, oh my God, you know, when I have these under cabinet lights in my kitchen, you know, and when I lift and put a dish from the dishwasher onto the cabinet, it's like I get sunburn. And on these questions that I just never had thought of, because they were so much a part of me. Like, is your stomach upset? It's like, well, always in knots. Went on and on, and he said, yeah, so ADHD, you could absolutely, you know, it's a spectrum. I mean, you could be properly diagnosed with Asperger's, what I think probably we tend to call this would be a sensory processing disorder. And what falls under that umbrella, when people come and present with these symptoms that, you know, that you have, one of the things that I see, that we see, I think he said, is the adaptive memory is different. So in other words, when you're a little child and you know, you have to know how to get into the high chair, as soon as you graduate and you leave the high chair, the memory of how the strap functions, the memory of how to get into the high chair evaporates. It leaves. The brain releases that memory so that new memories can form. But people with what you have tend to retain those memories. So we see people with sensory processing disorder who have memories that extend deep, 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 deep into early childhood and are complete.
Interesting.
And I was like,
so he's like now describing.
Oh my God, where were you when Good Morning America or whatever it was like in my living room asking me how I can remember these? It's like, it's medical. But it's true because, you know, before I was a writer, sometimes I would amuse myself by just, you know, laying in bed and revisiting a prior experience, something tiny, you know, that was ages and ages and ages and ages ago.
Yeah. So it's like there's something that's literally in some way neurologically atypical that allows you to almost watch the movies in vivid detail
in
a way that most other people just don't have access to.
I don't have control over it. And it's odd because I actually I consider myself to be someone with a poor memory in that I'm not good with names. I'm not good with like, what did I do last week? I have no idea. I often don't know the month. I don't even know how old I am because I'm in my 20s. I skipped a year. So I think I went from 22 to 24 and forgot to be 23. And that messed me up. So when anybody says, how old are you? I was like, I was born in 1965. So I don't know, like
whatever that comes
out to. Whatever that comes out to, and I'm not good at math, so in there. I can't learn languages, and I've tried. So I don't have control, but what I do have is like, I have recall.
Right.
So when I go back, I can go back and revisit. I never think I can, because when I think of like, okay, I'm going to go back to whatever period, like there's nothing there until I'm at my laptop, you know, and my eyes are closed and I got to have one little trigger, one thing. I've got to have one memory.
Like a jumping off point. Yeah.
Exactly. And then it all floods right back.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like it's almost like you can't make it happen, but you can open the door
Right.
You create the circumstances that let it come.
I can't select what I'm going to remember. I can't select it, but...
So when you sit down to write something then, right, you've written a number of different memoirs now and some fiction. So when you sit down to write the first time, you're like, okay, so there's a new thing I'm going to sit down and start on. Do you sit down at that moment knowing what it's going to be, or do you sit down and just kind of say, okay, let's see what happens?
Absolutely not. It's always a surprise. And with this book, my new book, it was the biggest surprise of all because my previous book was called Lust and Wonder, and that was a memoir. And I felt like that's the last memoir. Because if you sort of read Running with Scissors and then Dry and then Lust and Wonder,
It's like it covers.
It's, you know, it's a trilogy, really. And I didn't know it, but it is. And that's all you ever need to know about me. And I've got other books that are collections of essays, and there's a Christmas book and a Horrible Father book. And, you know, those are separate kind of things. And they're memoirs, but they're separate. Never going to write another memoir. That's it. Going to write, you know, a thriller. And I'm getting, you know, nowhere on it and struggling with it and trying to figure it out and make it work. And our great Dane comes in one day with a horrible limp. We go to the doctor and he's got a torn ACL and it requires invasive surgery and he's got to remain still for a month, you know. So I buy a memory foam mattress, put it in the living room, back one edge up against a wall with an armoire at one end, and I shove the couch up on the other side, and then I flip a table over on its side. So it's like this big sort of playpen.
Right.
And then I'm in there with him. With my laptop, and I'm like working on my novel that's horrible and like not going anywhere. And then I just start writing something else. And something that I was never going to ever write or ever talk about, ever, ever, ever. And it came out so fast and furiously. It was, so I'm not even sure how many words the final manuscript is. Maybe it's like 80,000, but I wrote like 355,000 words in days.
Wow.
I destroyed the laptop. I ended up with two forms of tendonitis, one of which I'm still, like you see me, I'm pressing on my arm still because it was just an explosive experience. And I did not plan on writing that memoir.
Good Life Project is sponsored by Lexus GX. So have you ever owned something that inspired you to just up your game? For me, it was this high-end mountain bike. I love the ultralight frame, the suspension, the precision gearing, and I realized it deserved to be ridden to its full potential. So I started training harder so I could experience the joy it could give back to me. And it paid off. That bike helped me discover just new levels of performance and straight up joy. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Imagine tackling rugged landscapes with the available 33-inch all-terrain tires and multi-terrain select, then unwinding with the available front row massaging seats. This is a vehicle that inspires you to go further, to live up to its full potential. So why settle? Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
It's interesting to me because when you do that, you know, you're at a point where, like you said, you've got the trilogy and the other books out there, and you're absolutely known for not holding back and being very honest and very raw and very real. It's like, well, I would imagine a lot of people would say, well, what else could there be right. that you would actually say this will never come out? And what it is. It's kind of magical.
Well, I would always, when people would ask me, is there anything that you won't, I mean, a lot of what I've written is not flattering to me, and I'm totally fine with that. I mean, I've made a lot of mistakes. I mean, yeah, bad stuff happened to me, but I also did awful things. I did awful things, and I'm not going to, you know, spit shine that. It's just... It is what it is. So when people would ask me, is there anything about your life that's off limits? I would always reply, no, no, no. I would, nope. And it never dawned on me that I was not being truthful. I was not being transparent. That, in fact, there was something about myself that is such a huge part of myself and has been my entire life. But it's something that I had never told anyone, not my husband, my best friend. I mean, it's something that my mother and I shared. My aunt, which was my grandmother's sister, the women in her family, when I would visit down in Cairo, Georgia, that's when I could talk about this aspect of my personality, of my being, but every day with my mother. So running with scissors is about my mother in the throes of mental illness and chaos. And, you know, she was a character and she was funny and crazy and, but she was very, very, very different before mental illness and mismedication ravaged her mind. So what happened was, I was on a bus, and this is what the book is about. I was you know, tormented in elementary school, bullied all the time for lots of different things. But I always, you know, used to space out. That's what they called it, when I'd be blank, just blank. And I wouldn't have a thought in my head, and I'm still like that. I'll be looking off somewhere. Like, this will happen to me when I'm backstage, and I'll be like, really, I guess I look intense because I'm staring. And someone will say, I'm sorry you look so deep in thought, but I just wanted to let you know 5 more minutes. But the truth is, I don't have a thought in my head. So I was on the bus. I was 8. And I always liked the hump seat. So when you get on the bus, I was on the side the driver's on. Dirt road. And there are 2 little bridges the bus had to go over to get to my house. And I felt the bump on the first bridge. And I'm staring out the window. And it's just a blur. My eyes are not focused, so it's just a blur, the blur of trees. And then I remember they happened at the same time, the second bump of the bridge and my grandmother. It's like the bump knocked my grandmother's head into my head, and she was bloody. And it's difficult for me to put into words what it is. It was knowledge. It was something very, very bad has happened to my grandmother now. And the bus stopped just a few seconds later. I got out of the bus. I ran up the driveway, rang the door, bang, bang, bang. And, you know, my mother answers it, and she's got the phone cord pulled from the kitchen all the way out to the front door, and I am frantic. My grandmother, I called her Amma. What's the matter with Amma? What happened to Amma? Something happened to Amma. Something's wrong with Amma. And my mother cupped her hand on the phone and said, what? Something happened to Amma. What's the matter with Amma? And my mother went back to the phone, speaking to her brother, Mercer. Yes, Mercer. Chris just came in. My name was Chris because I changed my name legally when I was 18, so I was born Chris. And my mother is saying, okay, yeah, well, you call me, I'll, you know. And my mother hung the phone up and she said, okay, what did you say? And I said, something bad has happened to Amma. And she said, that was your Uncle Mercer calling from the hospital. Your grandmother's been in a car accident and she has a punctured lung and a lacerated forehead, but she's going to be okay. And I said, she's going to be okay, okay. And then I said, Mom, how did I know that? And my mother had the strangest look on her face of like, surprise, relief, joy, delight, mischief. I mean, it was just, and she sort of got down, you know, on her knees to my level. And I'm really distraught, and her face is not matching the situation. And she took me in her arms and she said, "Because you are my son." And I was like, "Okay, what does that mean? This is like, Mom, how did I?" She sits me down and she says, "Do you know what a witch looks like?" You know, it's like, well, like on The Wizard of Oz, like, you know, I like the bad witch better. The good witch seemed airheaded and stupid. And my mother was like, "Well, yes, that's beside the point. But witches do not have, you know, green, pointy green faces, noses and warts and pointy hats. Witches look like me and your grandmother and your Aunt Curtis. And they look like you." And I said, "Wait, so I'm a witch?" And she said, "Indeed. But I didn't know that until now." And she explained that when my brother was born, she thought there was something different about him, but it was not. He hadn't inherited the gift. And when I came along, she just thought she had two normal, one odd, but, you know, two non-witched. And then she had her confirmation that. So thus began my relationship with my mother, where after school, every day, come home, I'd sit. She painted. She wouldn't look at me much, but she would teach me about what this is. So my mother was a very, she was a creative person. She was artistic, but she was also very scientific. All the women on my mother's side were. My grandmother was a scholar, a Latin scholar. My great aunt Curtis, I call her my Aunt Curtis, but she's actually my great aunt Curtis, was, she programmed the first satellite, and she was a mathematician, worked for Bell Laboratories. And my mother had read Albert Einstein's Theory of Relativity, I mean, the day that it was translated. Hmm. And understood it completely and had me read it from a very, very early age. And she was a physics scholar and a scientist. And so she taught me, okay, witchcraft. It's the most natural thing in the world. It's not supernatural. It's hypernatural.
Right, so she wasn't saying this is some sort of mystical thing. This is, let me describe it according to the laws of science.
Yes. Yeah. It is something neurological that people do not understand. It's an absolutely natural thing, but it's a personal, private thing. Because if you tell people, "I knew my grandmother was injured in a car accident, even though she was 2,000 miles away," they're going to think you're crazy. So we don't talk about it. It's something we never talk about because people don't understand it and you'll be a joke. And I got that because I was teased enough. So I wasn't going to be a joke. You know, so she taught me that, you know, look, there's different people practice magic in different ways. And there's people who are very ceremonial. We're not. She explained that it is about incredible focus. It is not wanting. Well, she said there are two things. You know, there's many, many sides. It's a complicated thing, and it's not even, of course, she didn't understand it all. But my moments of spacing out, she said, that's an enormous gift for receiving information. Information about events that are perhaps happening right now, but are distant, or that have happened, have occurred, but we haven't reached that moment yet on the timeline. We don't understand, my mother said, what time is. We think it's the thing on our watch. Our watch is measuring, but we don't understand what it is, really. She talked about, so that was in terms of, you know, sort of having a sense of one quality many witches have, is like a sense of something about to happen, or that is, or a sense about another person, or, you know, and that kind of, but also of conjuring, causing something to occur, something to happen. And my mother instructed me that it's not about wanting. It's about certainty. It is certainty based on very powerful focus. So to hone and refine my focus, we built together what's called a memory palace. And she taught me that, you know, before, long before the written word, people would remember things by building houses in their minds, castles in their minds. And they would design a house in their head, and they would, every day they would think about it. So you walk in the front door, and to the right, there's going to be this long chest. How many drawers does the chest have? Well, let's think. Let's give the chest six drawers. So in the first drawer of that chest, when you walk in, let's put a key in there. And all through the house. So everything, you know, furnished. And so my mother would then, you know, sometimes say, Krius, you know, in the room with the white canopy, where is the lilac pen? And I'd be like, oh, well, that's in the chest underneath the black hats. It's in the white box. And that helped me hold an image in my mind, because in order for to make something happen, you have to focus, you have to see it unwavering with such clarity and such penetrating intensity that something happens, and a thing occurs, a thing that you wanted to occur, that you decided has occurred, occurs. But not always. I remember having a dream as a kid, and I write about this in the book, having a dream where I'm in a room with people, and I'm able to float over them, you know, like hover. So, of course, when I wake up, I'm trying that. And I go to my mother, and I'm like, so I had this dream, and I could float, and I'm trying to float. And she said, so why do you think it is that you couldn't rise above the room and hover? And I was like, because maybe I wanted it, or my intent wasn't strong enough. And she said, no. It's because you cannot levitate in a room full of people. We can't do that. You can't do something that's not possible. We can do many things that people think are not possible, but we cannot defy any laws of the universe. However, we can appear to defy laws of the universe because the laws of the universe are not properly understood. But no, you can't hover. Just like you can't snap your fingers on your favorite show, Bewitched, and, you know, make a baked Alaska appear on the table. Nah. That's not a thing you can do in real life. So that has been a part of me all my life, totally taken for granted, never talked about, just a private thing, and I never doubted it. So whenever I would have a weird feeling about something, it was like I was given information. It was like I was given a professional briefing. I didn't doubt it. You know, I was like, I just acted on it.
Nah. So when you sit down, Great Dane next to you healing, and just using your words, destroy your computer, getting this all out. And then you realize this is a book. And then you realize, okay, so this is the one thing that has been a through line in my life since, you know, I was born. I have been largely transparent about so much, but not this one thing. And now, you know, this is not just me sharing this with my husband, my friends, and, but this is me actually taking this one piece, putting it into the form of a book, and putting it out into the world. Did you have any more? I'm curious what your internal, what your self-talk was around that, and whether it was different compared to anything you've written in the past.
Oh, completely different. No, I've never been afraid to publish a book, and this one was. Totally terrified the whole time, dreading publication day. Like, I've never dreaded anything because I get it. I really get it. Oh my God, now he's a witch. I mean, I'm the thing that kids dress up as at Halloween. If I weren't a witch, I wouldn't believe in it, and I would privately make fun of people who were. I mean, I would. I'd be like, oh yeah, they're a witch, and that's precious, you know? So I it's so easy for me to get into that headspace, to see, to, it's easy for me to not be me and look at me and be like, oh my God. But here's the thing. I actually think that the thing that we call witch or witchcraft, as my husband says, it needs a new name and a new PR agent. I think it's something that that is, if not part of everybody, part of a lot of people, and more developed in some. I think it is leftover. You know, if you think about our very earliest days on this planet as human beings, when the mother, the woman, was home with the children, the man, her mate, was out on a trip to gather food. If something dangerous occurred at home, if, you know, bobcat showed up or a bear, that woman, she needs to kind of text her husband and say, you got to get the fuck home now, dude, because there's a bear. You need, our species would have a greater chance for survival if that were possible. And it seems to me that it was possible. I liken it to dogs and the fact that dogs hear a higher frequency of sound energy than we can hear. But let's phrase that another way. For us, those sounds are not real things. We do not hear them. None of us hear them. We don't interact with them. They don't bother us. They don't affect us. They're not real. They're not part of the world. We have technology that detects the sound. Dogs can hear the sound because they have different neurons. So we know that those sounds are in fact part of the world. They are there. Well, is that it? Really? Really? Is that really it? How is it possible? How is it possible that as a little boy, I knew moments after my grandmother had been in a car accident with a forehead laceration and a punctured lung, that I knew something bad had happened and I had a flash of her forehead with blood? How could I know that? Well, the scientific answer occurred in the 80s through a paper written by two statisticians. And that paper was a seminal paper called The Law of Truly Large Numbers. And the law of truly large numbers says, you don't really understand statistics, so allow us to explain to you that what coincidence you experience as significant is statistically insignificant and, as a matter of fact, predicted. Of course, you will one day sit on a plane beside someone who's got your same name and maybe you're from the same hometown. That, even though in the moment it feels important, it's not. It's to be expected statistically. And if it didn't happen, that's what would be unusual. Thank you very much. But what the law of truly large numbers fails to explain is, what if it happens again? And then again, and then again, and 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 again. Is it still insignificant? No. I think that the answer is, we have a lot. It reveals a bald spot in our knowledge of how the universe works. Nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. And yet we have this thing called quantum entanglement. So quantum entanglement is, let's say we have two particles, you know, we put them in play school together and then we separate them, you know, and we put one particle at this end of the universe and put the other particle all the way at the other end of the universe and so far away that our human brains cannot comprehend it. Trillions of light years separate these two particles. And if you tickle the feet of this particle, they both laugh at exactly the same time. And this is not a theory, it's a fact. It's been demonstrated, it's known. What's not known is how it's possible, because it appears to defy the laws of physics. How can information travel great distance simultaneously? And that tells you, well, obviously, distance isn't what we think it is.
Yeah.
And probably the speed of light isn't what we think it is. You know? I mean, nothing can go faster than the speed of light as measured by whom? I mean, Albert Einstein himself said that there is no preferred point of reference in the universe. So how is it possible to even measure it ever accurately, ever? How? And you know what? It's really difficult to get an answer to these questions. You get a lot of, what you don't understand, and people dive into, physicists, you know, will dive sort of right into the math of it. And the truth is they don't know. They don't know what time is. And I don't either, but I do know that information does travel great distances into people through channels that we don't understand. And I think a lot of people have what I have to greater or lesser degrees, but they name it something else. I had a hunch. I just had a really weird feeling about it. Women's intuition. I mean, how many times, if you think about it, has something happened to you, and it's a small thing. It's a small thing. Suddenly you're thinking about someone you haven't thought about in 20 years, and boom, they send you a message on Facebook or they tweet at you. That has happened to millions of people. And it's just something that we think, it's funny, it's weird, it's a weird coincidence. How many times has, thank God I didn't do X, because look what happened if I had done it. if my plans, you know, I mean, I just think it's this hunches people have, intuitions people have, gut instincts, bad feelings that in hindsight turned out to be accurate and correct is all part of the same thing.
Yeah, it's sort of the just because a phenomenon doesn't have an obvious provable according to sort of like popular methodology.
Well, it may very definition. Well be provable. Do you know that the year I wrote this last year, they discovered a new organ in the body. So understand, we've been dissecting the body
a lot of years
for eternity, right? When I took anatomy and physiology in community college for the, you know, quarter of a semester that I was there, I learned, we understand the body. The physiology, we're still learning, you know. And yet they found an organ and it turns out to be the largest organ. Oops. It's actually, it's in the skin and it's something that they thought, they assumed it was like a interstitial.
Right, inert. You're talking about fascia or?
Yeah. It's, I forgot the name of it, but perhaps that is the name. But it's just shocking that in this day and age, new anatomy can be discovered. And, you know, in the brain too, regions of the brain that we don't.
Yeah, I have a number of neuroscientist friends who will readily tell you that what is known about the way that the
Absolutely.
Brain functions is the universe of what is not known about it is, mm-hmm. is far greater than the universe of what is known. So we're literally sitting in the studio today, the day after this book that sort of like reveals this lifelong secret and set of capabilities. That book was out like literally the day before as we record this. And so it's out in the world and you're starting to talk about it and seeing how people are interacting with it. Do you feel any more or less comfortable as it's now, it's no longer anticipation, but this is out in the world.
Mm-hmm. I'm more comfortable with it.
Yeah.
You know, anticipatory stress is always the worst.
Yeah, the worst.
That's the killer.
Yeah. It'll always get you.
But I think that, I mean, I really think that statistically speaking, it should hit a nerve like the other books have. I think that while my experience was different in that being, you know, growing up the son of a witch and as a witch and coming from a family that embraced it and, you know, had a measure of understanding for it and full belief, that's a little bit less common. But I think what's universal is the are many of the experiences that I talk about,
right, sort the
of
phenomena,
knowing something that before it happens, or knowing something I couldn't possibly know, or having a, you know, a sixth sense, so to speak, about something. And I think what I want people to understand. One woman came up to me last night, and she said, after the reading, she said, "I really related to what you talked about." And I've talked about it in my life as sort of, you know, the universe telling me. But it sounds like it's like what you're saying, it's witchcraft. And I was like, that's the word that I use that I've grown up with. And I love, because I love the history of it. But it's the same thing.
Yeah, it's like, it doesn't matter what you name it.
It's the same. It's the same yeah. thing, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's that's what it is. And you know what? I don't know what it is. I don't know why I don't always have control over it at all. Often, I will have a daydream or an image and it won't occur to me, you know, that in a few hours it'll happen or in a few days or. When I'm in the throes of it, I don't often get that. I don't, for some reason, pull back and say to myself, wait, why are you doing this? What's going to, I'm not logical or I'm not,
It's more reflective than
that way. Just do it.
So as we sit here, it feels like a good place for us to start to come full circle as well. In the container of this, it's a good life project, conversation about really living a good life, the elements of it. If I offer out that phrase, to live a good life for you at this moment where you're at, what lands?
I'm really, really happy with my life. You know, I feel fortunate to be married to my best friend and to be living in, I mean, really the house I always wanted to live in, which is one that's so old, there's not I feel drunk walking in it without being drunk. And I love the feeling of being tipsy, but I don't have to drink because there's not a straight line in the house. I love an old house with our dogs and property. And I love that, and I've kind of, I'm even more so at a place where I take risks. And I like that I'm not shutting down as I get older. You know, like I watched my father do. I watched him just shut down and become smaller and smaller and more rigid. And I'm really the opposite. I mean, I'm doing new things all the time and making mistakes, but not the old mistakes I used to make, but brand new mistakes, you know? And I beat myself up, I think, a lot less. I'm very forgiving. You know, one thing is been really helpful is to realize, oh God, yeah, all that stuff about myself that's like really annoying, and that's never going to actually change. Like, I'm never going to get over that. So I'm not even going to try. I'm defective in certain ways. I'm a catastrophist. Oh, well, I am. That's just never going to go. There's no pill. I'm not going to do that. I'm not sitting on a therapist's couch for 9 years talking about my mother when that's not going to get me through. That's not how to fix it. Some things, they don't get fixed. Some things, some issues, they're not going away. So you incorporate them and find out. Here's one thing I've learned. Every horrible thing that I've experienced, there's always been a present inside. You got to dig, but there's always been a present glittering. And you just have to find it. One thing that, you know, loss, I think, when you lose someone, very, very, very important, someone you can't lose, and then you do. It's a hole. You have a hole blown, a cannonball hole blown right through you, and it feels like you're going to die. But holes create more surface area. That's what a hole does. Like a Swiss cheese has more surface area than American cheese because of the holes. So the holes we have, they don't have to make us darker. They can make us deeper. And that happens by accepting and the loss. And the way to accept it is you have to go through it. You have to feel it and realize it's real and realize they're never coming back. They're gone. And then one day, many years from now, you know, if you're in a place where you're going through something that, a loss that's unbearable, 5 years, 6, 7 years, the best thing, one of the best things to ever happen to you could happen. Something you never imagined. And you will feel that joy and the bliss of such wonderful experience. And at the same time, you will feel the loss that you have because it never goes away. And the wonderful experience, the wonderful joy you feel, and the loss will sort of sit together on the park bench inside your heart. And like two old people, they'll sit there. And that sounds really screwed up and weird, but that is the way it is. You don't get to erase anything. There is no way to make an awful thing less awful, but there is a way to continue to have wonderful, miraculous, exciting experiences so that you become a well of wonderful and tragic and heartbreak and joy and all of that. And that's what gives you gravity and depth. I am so grateful today that I was molested as a little boy, because I have had the opportunity many times to sit down next to a young girl or boy at school who has been molested, and I have been able to really hear them, understand them, and make them see you're going to actually be so okay. This is not going to screw you up for life. It's not. Someday, you're actually going to be grateful. It's horrible. It's ugly. You didn't want it. But it's given you a strength. And I wouldn't have that if I hadn't been abused. I wouldn't know how to talk to other victims of sexual abuse. I wouldn't know. And you know what? It's actually really good to know how, because you can change their life. You can improve another human being's life. That, yeah, worth it. Absolutely worth it. 100% worth it. Would never go back and undo that. Because I wrote about it, people connected with it, and felt less alone. They felt like, oh my God, I'm not the only one. You know, and this last point I'm going to make on this, I wrote this book called This Is How, which is like it's a self-help book for people who are psychologically ambitious and want to really fix themselves and don't want to just waste time. It's like how to really do it. And I talked about loss, and a group of young women, teenagers, came up to me in New England. And I couldn't hear what they were saying because it was loud, and I was like, she said, we are from Newtown, Connecticut, Sandy Hook, which was in the news. We all lost younger siblings in Sandy Hook, and we wanted you to know that your book is the only thing that's keeping us alive. That woman's comment to me made everything I ever went through worth it. Absolutely worth it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening, and thanks also to our fantastic sponsors who help make this show possible. You can check them out in the links we have included in today's show notes. And while you're at it, if you've ever asked yourself, what should I do with my life? We have created a really cool online assessment that will help you discover the source code for the work that you're here to do. You can find it at sparkatype.com. That's SparkeType.com. www.thebestofbeth.com or just click the link in the show notes. And of course, if you haven't already done so, be sure to click on the subscribe button in your listening app so you never miss an episode. And then share the love. If there's something that you've heard in this episode that you would love to turn into a conversation, share it with people and have that conversation. Because when ideas become conversations that lead to action, that's when real change takes hold. See you next time.